accession number 22342, reel 12.
Trooper Bowdler, reel 12. You're saying you'd arrived back at Coconada and the regiment had left their Lee tanks, Grant Lee tanks, in the jungle.
That's right.
Yes.
Fired off all the ammunition out at sea. Got rid of the ammunition. What remained. And just disabled the tanks as much as we were. Took the firing pins out of the guns and put sand in the carburetor. Generally mucked the tanks up. And then left them. And we were drawn by boat and lorry and that sort of thing. And train. And they eventually ended up in Coconada, which was our old base. And it was decided that we were going to be part of the invasion. I think it was Malaya. and we were issued with Sherman DD tanks. That was the one with a canvas screen around. Two engines, two propellers, and this screen, which was erected by compressed air. It had an air compressor which filled the tubes with air and took up a framework which is erected this canvas screen to get the displacement to float a Sherman. And so our lives were very busy.
What were you doing? I mean, you said you'd lost your place in the tank crew you'd been in, obviously, because you were injured.
Yes.
What happened to you when you got back?
Well, when I got back, I was reinstated once I got fit again. I had a period of convalescence.
How long did it take before you were fully fit to go back into a tank crew?
Oh, I suppose about a couple of months, something like that. Yes.
What were you doing when you were convalescent? They must have found something for you to keep you occupied.
I think we were running courses and things like that in the camp, you know. So I was brushing up on the Morse and that sort of thing, because we used Morse. And then we had to learn semaphore for these tanks.
Ah.
Because they really were issued with semaphore flags.
So you could
was supposed to
communicate with the Navy, presumably.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And it was never used, of course. We didn't never use it. But we were taught it. And so a lot of the time was taken up in training sessions and things like that, which didn't tax you at all. Not physically.
What happened once you were fit? Were you a driver again, or were you an operator?
Yes, well, there came a time when sort of people were being repatriated.
Yes.
They'd done their stuff and they were being repatriated. So my driver's position very quickly became vacant again and I was back in the crew.
Were you back with the same crew that you'd been with before?
No, it was a different crew. Yes.
Was it back in C Squadron or had you...
Oh no, I was in C Squadron all the time. Yeah. And some of the guys in my tank, yes, we were. Of the who I were in action with,
yeah,
but because of the there was a lot of movement going on, you know, people going home, being sent home, and other people coming in. So the crew wasn't exactly the same as it was while we were in action, but nevertheless, we got on quite well together.
What did you think of the Sherman as a tank? Compared to the Grant Lee?
It was very much the same, actually. The only difference was that it was more lightly armed. It didn't have the firepower that the Grant and the Lee had. It just had the 75mm gun in the turret. There's a model of it there. These are the two tanks I drove during the war. There you go. It had the 75mm in the turret. And it was a good tank, very good tank.
What about the machine guns? I mean, it presumably had machine guns as well as the main arm.
Yes, it had the two machine guns in the front, just yes. the same, and the coaxially mounted machine gun with a 75mm.
Mm. But no 37?
No 37.
What was it like to drive? Was it the same kind of feel?
Exactly the same. It had the same gearing and everything.
Oh, front, I see.
The front of the tank was more or less exactly the same. You sat astride the main gearbox, the final drive here.
Yeah.
Sat astride that with the levers either side of you. And so it was very similar. But the DD tank was a different kettle of fish. It, it had two engines instead of one. And you had to get the two engines completely synchronized. So, you know, they had to rev at the same speed and all the rest of it. So it was quite a complex thing to drive. Or to work. But driving it was very similar, you know, just a matter of pulling levers and watching the revs. But it was a bit of an adventure, really, getting those, because we they took possession of a sand spit out at sea. And the tanks eventually were all transported over to the sand spit, landed on it, and we they erected a tower with a tank on it. I mean, a water tank, not a one of these.
Yes.
A water tank on it. Two water tanks, in fact. One at the top, one at the bottom. In the bottom tank, they had the driving compartment and turret of one of these tanks. Right? And a whacking great pipe, which came down from the top tank, which they filled with seawater and pumps. And part of the training was escape from this, if it sank.
Ah.
So you would go into this bottom tank it was one big tank, that's right, one long tank like that. And the tank was at the bottom and the water inlet was at the top. And what they would do is it would be empty. You would climb down a ladder into the tank, take a position up with an instructor, and then they would open a huge valve on the top and let this water in. It would come thundering down into the tank, and you had to sit there while the water came up and up and up and up. And you had a bag, canvas bag and rubber lined bag on your chest, which was filled with oxygen and strapped to you with a mouthpiece and nose clips. And at a given signal, when the water was up to there, the instructor would say, right, put your mouthpiece and nose clips on. You did that and opened the valve and started breathing
oxygen
in and out of this bag, which gradually got weaker in oxygen and stronger in carbon dioxide. So it had a limited thing to it. But it was enough to get you out of the tank if there was a problem. And we would sit in there and they'd fill the damn thing right up, so the water would go way up to the top of the tank. And then you had to escape. So you were taught how to do that.
How did you escape when you were underwater?
We just opened the hatch and went. But you had to do it in sequence. Driver goes first, somebody else second, somebody else third, and so on, like that.
Well, why did the driver go first?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that he did go first, come to think of it. Probably the commander went first, I don't know. But you had to take it in turns, I do remember that. And it was all very controlled and very calm and all the rest of it. And of course you, with the buoyancy of this bag of oxygen on your chest, you shot up to the surface like a rocket. But it seemed to take a long time to get there. And eventually you bobbed out to the top and that was it. That was the exercise done.
How many times did you do that escape exercise?
Several times. I can't remember the number exactly, but we did it several times. And what we did mostly was we used to go out to this sand spit in the morning very early in the morning and mount our tanks, in complete darkness, drive out in them into the sea, down the beach and into the sea, with our screens inflated. And we'd wander around a bit out there, and as the dawn approached, we'd make a dawn landing on the beach. And as you came up the beach, there was a plate at the back of the tank there, which had a pressure switch underneath. And when the water level reached that plate, that switch, it sounded a buzzer inside the tank, which told you to either drop the screen or erect it and traverse the gun to forward position.
How did you drop the screen? What was?
You just pulled a lever and let all the air out of the support tubes. And this structure came down like a ton of bricks, down, woof, and the screen was all folded up around the outside of the tank down there.
Well, was the screen permanently attached? Could it be used more than once?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So you could use
you could blow it up and bring it down, blow it up, bring it down. Mm. Yes, it was fully functional.
How did the tank handle when you were out at sea with it?
Hopeless, absolutely hopeless. You had very little controllability out of the thing. Its speed was very, very slow. You relied on the two propellers, which were driven from the tracks, through a gearing. They were quite large propellers on the back, and you still use the sticks, and you could increase the speed of one propeller or decrease it on the other, so that gave you steerage, but of a very primitive kind, you know. And the because of the bulk of the thing, I mean, the tank itself was completely underwater.
Yes.
And this sort of canvas screen came up there, about there. Mm. You could just see over the top of it. If you stood on the deck of the tank, you could just see over the top of the screen. And I suppose it was a wonderful invention, because for anybody on shore, it looked like a small boat coming ashore. Small boat. And, of course, when it came ashore, you felt your tracks touching the bottom. You felt the bumping and your tracks touching. Your tracks were going round with the propellers, because they were driven from the same sort, and she would start to come up and up and up and up. And as I say, when the water pressure dropped on this switch here, a red light would come on and a buzzer sound in the cab, and you drop the screen, traverse the gun, charge up the beach, and into action. Mm. That was the theory. And it worked. Yes, it worked. I think it was tried out in Germany for the crossing of the Rhine. But, we practiced all this, and one day I went out for a dawn landing like that in the Bay of Bengal, and a storm blew up. Very sudden storm. It's subject to those sort of things. And the sky went as black as ink, and in no time at all there were huge 6-foot waves hitting this thing, and it lapped over the top, and before you could say knife, it had filled with water. We sank like a stone.
How far out from the shore were you?
Oh, we were a good way out.
Good way out.
Yeah, they never recovered the tank. It was hopeless, lost in deep water, and it sank like a stone. Fortunately, we had rescue craft cruising around. Mm. The rescue craft were donies, what we call donies.
What's a donie?
A donie is a hollow log. Mm. Hollowed out,
dug out canoe.
Yeah, with an outboard motor on on the back. And it didn't go over waves, it went through them.
Mm.
Pierced straight through. And they were circling all the time we were doing these exercises. Fortunately, they were.
Mm.
But my tank was a complete loss. My tank commander, Booker, Reggie Booker, who owned a pub in Acton, the Red Lion in Acton, at the time, he'd done a very foolish thing. He was standing in the turret with his headphones on and his bush hat with his chin strapped down. And on these headsets, we all had them in decom units, there was a snatch plug, so that when you wanted to get out in a hurry, you just pull the thing, a snatch plug. And it should come apart. His didn't. It jammed. And he was dragged by the chin down to the bottom. And how deep it was, I do not know. But we all bobbed to the surface, one after another. And of course, it's very difficult to see people when there are big waves going. You're a little black dot. Very difficult to see each other. Anyway, looked around, and eventually I identified that we were all there except poor old Booker. He wasn't there. And I said, God almighty, left-hand stern there. And I did a stupid thing. I started diving from the surface down to see if I could find him. And of course it was hopeless, so I ran out of breath long before. I mean, it was pretty deep, I should imagine. And my chief concern was sharks, because I was bleeding.
How were you bleeding? Why were you bleeding?
Well, I caught my... When I went to go out, we had at the back of the driver was what they called a Kleygas knob. It was for starting in cold weather.
Mm.
You could enrich the mixture by pulling this lever. Well, on getting out, my epaulet caught in the lever, and I couldn't get out. And in my struggles, I banged myself and bled. And poor old Booker, when he came to the surface, he did eventually come to the surface. I think he was in a bad way.
Had he been right down to the bottom?
I think he had. I have no means of telling, but he must have done, because the tank sank like a stone. I mean, it went straight to the bottom, as it would, I mean, 37 tonnes. And he eventually came up, gasping for breath, in a terrible state. Blood coming out of his mouth, and the frayed ends of his snatch plug, he'd torn the cable on that.
No, because it wouldn't come apart.
Because it wouldn't come apart. And his struggles were so desperate, they'd actually torn away. And I swam across to him and supported him and said, you're okay, so you're up, and all that sort of thing. And he was, and bleeding. And I thought, God, sharks. And I was very conscious of my legs dangling underneath
me. Yes.
All that sort of thing, you know. I really was terrified. But I screamed out, come and pick the commander up to the Donis. They'd spotted our trouble, and they came towards us. And they managed to drag him over the side and into the boat. And then one by one we went in. And we got on shore. They drove us back on shore. And I was shivering with shock. I wasn't cold. We were all shivering, got the shakes, you know, with shock. And poor old Robbo, he's in a terrible state. Anyway, the squadron leader came over and thanked us all very much. Gave us all a shot of brandy. I remember that. That was lovely. Yes, he gave us a shot of brandy, and of course that calmed us down. And funny enough, Robbie was he was all right. Booker. He was okay. He recovered fairly quickly. He'd done a bit of damage, I think, to his lungs or something like that, because he was bleeding from the mouth. But he was back in action again fairly quickly. We got another tank issued, and we continued with our training. But after that, what happened was 12 of us drivers, about 12 I think it was, were sent as a detachment, and this was a very exciting expedition, sent as a detachment up to the Chinese at Lashio, on the Chinese border.
Why were you selected? Do you know why they decided to send you?
Because I was a driver. They were only drivers that went.
Yeah.
No other. Just 12 drivers were sent from the unit. We flew. We went by train. I think it was up to Camilla, and flew in Curtis Commandos. Of across the all these mountains where we'd previously been fighting, on up to... We eventually found our way to Lashio. We landed there by plane. And I tell you what, I've only thought this since. I'm pretty sure that the Chinese column, which was run by an American general, Vinegar Joe. You heard of Vinegar Joe?
Vinegar Joe Stillwell, yes.
He was running this outfit, and they had fought their way down to Lashio, which was just on the Chinese-Burma border. And I think Mountbatten was fully conscious of the fact that if the Chinese had have continued in their attack, they would have been into Burma, and it would have been a hell of a job to get them out. And I think he issued instructions they be stopped at Lashio, relieved of their tanks, which were needed down on the Sitang River Bend at the south of Burma, to continue down with the attack that was going on down there. So we were sent up there to get these tanks off the Chinese and drive them back down into the battle zone. Well, it was a momentous journey, it really was. I mean, we were going over impossible country for tanks.
Was it just drivers in the tanks?
Yes. And
nobody else?
Nobody else, just drivers.
That must have been rather difficult to steer than if you've got nobody directing you.
Well, that's right, yeah, but you were open all that, because we weren't.
You were opened up,
yeah,
yes.
We were opened up.
What condition were these tanks in when you took them over?
Yes, exactly. That's a good point. They were in a disgraceful condition. The Chinese weren't at all professional where tanks were concerned. And they were all pulled up in a line on the park, the tank park. And the Chinese guards were strutting up and down, tossing hand grenades about, trying to intimidate us, because they didn't want to lose the tanks. And there was a lot of bad feeling about it. And all we were interested in was doing our job. But the Chinese made it as difficult as they possibly could, and they tried to scare us. As I say, they march up and down with their rifles and machine guns, and tossing grenades about, and generally being unpleasant. But we got on with our job and sort of sorted the engines out and made sure they were all in working order. The tracks were okay, tension-wise and everything. And it ended up doing a clear-out job, because you got into the tank and it was full of... There was bullets rolling around in the floor, hand grenades rolling around. They were disgraceful, you know. I mean, they were not in any fit condition to go into action. So that's what we had to do. We each man was allotted a tank, which was his responsibility, and you did the mechanical work on it, tensioning the tracks and the engine and all that sort of thing, making sure it was full of oil, petrol and water.
What impression did the Chinese guards make on you? I mean, you said they were hostile, but
yes.
You know, what did you make of their physical condition and their weapons and equipment and so on?
They were in good condition. They were in good condition, but we didn't like them. They were inscrutable. We couldn't relate to them in any way. A bit like the Japanese, actually. We couldn't relate to them. But they were definitely angry at losing the tanks, and they held us responsible. And we had to charge out of there in the dead of night, actually, and get down the road quite a way. Anyway, we made it. We got away from their camp.
What sort of scale of force were you dealing with when you were up there? How many Chinese do you think there were in their camp?
I don't know. I really don't know. They were present, because we were confined to the park. We weren't allowed to go anywhere else.
So you were just in the tank park?
Yeah, we didn't go into Lashio itself or anywhere like that. We were strictly concerned with the tanks, so we didn't get to see anything. But the ones that we did come across were immediately in the tank park.
Mm.
And they were a pretty unpleasant bunch, you know, uncommunicative and threatening all the time. They had a threatening aspect about them.
Did you have any, were there any Americans there? Did you have any?
Yes, there were. There were Americans about, but mostly the Americans were mostly engineering types.
Mm.
And they were very good at their job. They weren't combatants. We came across them because when we left the Chinese camp, dumps had been made, and I suspect that these Americans had done all this. Fuel dumps had been set out in the jungle along the tracks that we were due to take, and a road had been sorted out to get us out.
Mm.
And so all that was done for us. We were given instructions where to drive to the next dump of fuel and food, and get on with the job of getting these tanks.
Who's in charge of your party for this?
We had a lieutenant.
Mm.
Just a lieutenant, that's all. And he handled the job pretty well, I must say. You know. But we felt dreadfully isolated because the country that we were going through had not been cleared of Japs. Mm. I mean, there were still wandering bands of Japs around. And it was quite dangerous, really. Mm. But we came to obstacles like rivers, where these Yanks would suddenly put in an appearance. They'd come paddling down the river in canoes, motorized canoes and things like that, and they'd meet us and they'd say, right, we're going to station a guy on the other bank and he'll signal to you which way you've got to go to ford the river. And we would ford this damn river was so fast and deep, and the bottom was all cobbles and rocks and boulders. Mm. And it was so deep that these were Sherman tanks, by the way, like these, not the screen ones.
Ordinary Sherman.
There's the driver's hatch.
Yes.
And the water was just lapping over the top of that, you know. And coming in, and you could feel these boulders under the tracks, and you could feel the tank being pushed sideways like this as you were going through the fast current. And this American on the other bank would do this for if he wanted you to go that way, and that if he wanted to go that way. And he guided us across. They'd obviously sounded it out beforehand. So we owed a great deal to them. They did a wonderful job. And in places where we had to cross rivers and chongs and things like that, and the banks were too steep, they would come along with a charge of dynamite and blast the bank flat so you could get out. Things like that.
And sounds like it was a really very well coordinated.
It was a very well support. Done exercise, I tell you. Yes, it was very well done.
Mm.
And from but the Japs didn't, the Yanks didn't seem to take any part in the fighting. They're huge men. Mostly of Irish extraction, and very genial. They liked. I got the impression they liked us because I remember VE Day came while we were doing this.
This was 6th of June, 1944.
Right. Mm. We were in the depths of jungle. You never saw him like it. Absolutely miles from anywhere, and we were. Camped up waiting for some assistance. We had to we had to cross a gorge, that's right, and it was a very steep gorge that we had to cross, and so we were waiting for these Yanks, and they came downstream in their canoes, and they said, hi buddy, have you heard the news? And we said, no, we haven't. And they said, the war in Europe's over. And that's the first we heard of it. They told
us. So this is 1945 then, not 44. This is May 1945.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And they came down and they got beer.
Mm.
Yeah, bottles of beer came down and they joined us and we had a drink. They were very generous, and food, beer and that sort of thing. And we had a bit of a sing-song and one thing and